Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, June 21st, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group telephone conference call, as today we discuss the foundations of Chevron. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome a new guest to Federalist Society today, Mark Seidenfeld. He is the Patricia A. Doerr Professor of Administrative Law at the Florida State University College of Law. He's going to give us opening remarks of about 10 to 20 minutes, but as always, we'll be looking to you for audience questions, so please have those in mind for when we get to that portion of the program. With that, Professor Seidenfeld, the floor is yours.
Thank you. I want to thank you for providing this opportunity and welcome everyone who's listening and will be asking questions. I want to introduce this as the notion of what is it that justifies Chevron, and where does that lead us in terms of what how Chevron should operate generally. The Supreme Court, in its most notably in the Meade decision, but in other cases, has premised Chevron on the notion of an implicit delegation of the authority to interpret statutes within the bounds of ambiguities or uncertainties in the statute, a delegation by Congress to the courts. I question whether that is an accurate assessment. I'm not the only one who's done that. In fact, most people who have looked at it as of 2010, when I wrote my first article on this, said that it was a legal fiction, although they found it to be a useful legal fiction. I wasn't so sure of that. I think it leads to approaches to Chevron and the actual operation of Chevron that might not be ideal. In addition, since then, there has been some work done that would perhaps call into question or lead people to say, well, maybe it's not such a fiction after all. In particular, there was a huge article by two professors, Abby Gluck and Lisa Bressman, on congressional statutory interpretation, which showed the Congress staff was very aware of the fact that when they leave ambiguities in the statute, that Chevron applies and that gives the agency a discretion to interpret the statute to fill in those ambiguities. My response to that is, first of all, there's nothing in the statute, in any of the statutes, that say, you know, the agencies get this interpretive primacy. So it's kind of implied, and it's implied best from the fact that, well, we've had Chevron since 1984, and therefore they know that this is going to happen. Of course, anything before 1984, they would not have any idea that this was going to happen, so that doesn't work. But even the awareness isn't enough, because the mere fact that you have ambiguity and that they know that that's going to lead to Chevron doesn't mean that that's what's intended or the way the statute should be read. There are lots of reasons why Congress would leave a statute ambiguous, not the least of which is to sort of punt the issue and avoid blame to the agency, or sometimes simply give up and say, you know, politically we can't get anything more clear through the Congress, yet we think it's important that we have a statute. And in both of those situations, it doesn't say anything about interpreting the statute. It may give the agency rulemaking authority, which is, again, Meade says that the agency has to have authority to act with the force of law and do so, interpret the statute in that capacity in order to get Chevron deference. But even that doesn't say that is something that Congress means to do when it leaves a statute ambiguous. There's been some people who have argued that, if you're going to leave gaps in the statute for rulemaking and the statute's ambiguous, that necessarily implies that an interpretive capacity or interpretive primacy, because, you know, the agency has already given the authority to fill gaps. In my first article in 2010, Chevron's Foundation, I questioned that with some examples that show that that's not true. For example, the notion that you can act with the force of law and fill gaps doesn't mean you get primacy. A district court reviewing interpreting a statute for the first time or interpreting a statute has the authority to issue interpretations and rulings with the force of law, and yet on review, the appellate court gives no deference to the district court decision. So it doesn't necessarily follow that the gap filling by rulemaking means that you have the authority to interpret the statute and fill gaps that way. Anyway, we get to this Gluck and Bressman argument, and you say, well, they're aware of this, but does that mean they intend to do this? And I would argue that in most cases, almost in all cases, that awareness was not an awareness that necessarily intention or even an awareness that they could do anything, but live with the fact that if it's ambiguous, the statute is ambiguous, that the agency gets interpretive primacy, whether they wanted that or not. Well, an article that came out in 2001, it came out later, but discussed the Dodd-Frank Act, an article by Kent Barnett, noted that in that act, one provision of that act, Congress did explicitly talk about the agency's deference to agency interpretations of the statute, and basically explicitly said that with respect to the controller of the currency's interpretations that would preempt state law, that those interpretations were not to be given Chevron deference, essentially, but were to be given Skidmore deference, which is a kind of deference that depends on the nature of the question, the care the agency took in addressing it, the consistency of the agency decision, and other factors that usually don't arise in the Chevron context. So in that situation, that really muddies the water, because Congress clearly envisioned and addressed the issue of Chevron and said, for this kind of question, courts do not apply Chevron. But again, I think that in some sense, Professor Barnett overstates the significance of that, because the mere fact Congress has done it once in the context of a statute where there was a lot of controversy about what the Comptroller General was doing, there was a clear indication by Congress it was only part of the statute, doesn't indicate a general awareness or predilection of Congress to say, we understand and want Chevron to apply, and we will explicitly overrule that or basically provide otherwise if we want to do so otherwise. Perhaps the best argument is the fact that since Chevron is essentially a default rule, if you have ambiguity, it applies. The problem with default rules in Congress are that, given a congressional inertia, default rules tend to stay in place often, even though that's not the intent of Congress, and not the language doesn't necessarily imply that that's the way the statute should work. It could work either way. The court comes up with a default rule. There's just not enough energy, so to speak, to get over the inertia of changing it, and so the default rule sticks even without any indication in the language or anything else that that's what the statute meant to do. So where we are now is I think there's much more awareness, especially now with the current Congress, about the fact that Chevron exists and that Congress might do something about it. But I'm not sure that in the context of particular statutes that merely creating ambiguity says anything about Congress's understanding of whether they have or haven't authorized Chevron deference in a specific sense. So that's the first part of what I call my revisitation of my original paper. This notion of the foundation of Chevron has some significant operational effects. In particular, Chevron can be divided. It used to be called the Chevron two-step. Now with Meade and the notion of the question whether Chevron should apply, we can talk about a step zero. And certainly, so there's a step zero, a step one, and a step two. Step zero, does Chevron apply to a particular interpretation in the context in which the agency interpreted the statute? Step one, in looking at the statute, does the court determine that there's silence or ambiguity, and perhaps what the bound of that is? Step two, was the agency's interpretation, despite the ambiguity or silence, permissible or reasonable? So at step zero, the Meade court, using this delegation approach, said, well, we don't think Congress would have implicitly delegated interpretive primacy to those decisions an agency makes that don't have the force of law. In particular, that would, for the most part, eliminate from Chevron deference things that are called guidance documents, policy statements, and interpretive rules, because those technically don't have independent force of law. You can't apply them as if they're a rule or a statute. They may tell you what the agency is planning to do. They may have practical effects, but they don't have any independent legal force. My alternative, by the way, to the delegation interpretation is that Chevron, in my mind, is better seen as a judicial doctrine that is one of self-limitation. The notion is the understanding, I think, that I teach my students anyway in constitutional law and administrative law is the notion that courts get to determine, you know, the judicial system determines facts, interprets the law, applies the law to the facts, but it doesn't make policy. And policy decisions are the domain of the political branches, Congress in the first instance, and within what Congress has given the authority to the executive branch, the agencies, and the president in that situation. And yet, we all know that interpreting statutes often involves, has implications of policy, and sometimes the court itself gets into the discussion of what the policy implications are and whether they're good or bad. Well, you know, that's probably can't be avoided in many situations where the court is interpreting the statute on its own without any background or anyone else who can do that. But when they're reviewing an agency interpretation, they're reviewing an interpretation of an institution that is one, more expert, and two, more politically accountable than the court itself. And in that situation, the court might say, look, I'm going to try to interpret the statute, and we get to step one. At step one, I'm going to try to see what it means and how it applies in this situation. But if I'm not comfortable or assured of that, then essentially that means that Congress hasn't resolved that issue, and that makes it a policy issue, right? It makes it an issue where the law doesn't say you have to do it. It doesn't say you can't do it. And yet there are implications about the way the world works from that. As a policy issue, I should defer to the more accountable and more expert agency in that situation. Given that, you know, psychologists will tell us, even if we try to avoid our own implicit policy and ideological biases in making decisions, it's impossible to do. So that's my understanding of Chevron. That leads to a different approach at step zero. At step zero, the argument would be, not has Congress delegated this and would Congress intend this to apply to something that doesn't have the force of law, but to what extent is the agency conscious of and exercising its policymaking discretion in a responsible manner? And to me, that means that we're talking about probably decisions that are made and interpretations made by those who are likely to be able to be held accountable for their decisions, heads of agencies, perhaps deputy heads of agencies, those certainly not below those who are subject to senatorial confirmation. If it's the head of a regional office who says, as a matter of enforcement, this is the policy for this office, that person could be overruled by the central office. But until and unless the central office deals with it, it's flying below the radar screen of accountability, political accountability. In addition, so I would want it to be someone who's pretty high up in the agency. The Supreme Court in Meade mentioned that they didn't want that Chevron shouldn't apply and Congress wouldn't intend it to apply when there are many people authorized to make the decision. I think that a better way of viewing that is when people can make the decision who aren't at a level where they're likely to be held politically accountable. The second part, the court also talked about procedures, and I have no problem with that. I think that the reason procedures matter is because procedures are a way of having the agency be self-aware that there's importance to what it's doing. That if there are procedures that have to be followed, unlike guidance documents, where the agency can just basically issue the guidance document, if they know they have to go through a notice and comment, if they know they have to go through a formal hearing, then that's a signal to the agency that this is important and that they should be careful about the determinations they're making, that these are going to have effects. And so those two factors I would include. But the force of law factor, which was the crux of me, the notion that that guidance documents can never get Chevron deference, to me, I would come out the other way on that and say it depends on who's issuing it, and whether the agency was self-aware. How much care did they take? Did they know they were doing something important here? So that takes care of the step zero implications. Step one, there may be implications, but they come up in certain contexts, so I'm going to skip over that for a second and get to step two, and then tell you. For step two, I think this is the most interesting and important of the different implications one would get from from the differences. If Congress has delegated interpretive primacy to the agency, and the court determines that the statute doesn't answer the question, then that's the end of it. And as long as the agency has it acted in a way that's so arbitrary as to sort of violate due process or be crazy, which would, I think, violate due process and arbitrariness notion of due process, I think the court has to defer to the agency because Congress has said, once you determine the statute's not determinative, the agency gets to decide. Under my approach, again, I get back to the notion of the court's responsibility to interpret the law ultimately, and that this is a self-limitation principle. And the court would say, we're perfectly willing to defer to the agency as long as we're sure the agency itself is doing its job. And that, to me, means that you would apply something along the lines of the hard look approach to reviewing agency decisions to its statutory interpretation. The agency should reveal what the policy implications are, what the effects will be, and some indication of why it made the decision that it made. And then the court could review that the same way it would review a rule, a policy determination under a rule. So that's the difference at step two. The last thing I want to talk about, which goes to step one ultimately, but the court has recently, in the King v. Burwell case quite explicitly, come up with what they call a major question exception to Chevron. And the major question exception to Chevron applies when the court feels that the question is of such national significance and importance that they said it's unreasonable to think that Congress would have left this decision to the agency. And therefore, Congress would not have left it to the agency. We, the court, have to determine what the statute means. The problem I have with this is, and this is, again, something that others have noted, it's not a choice between the choice that the court frames the major question as raising is between Congress and the agency. But once the statute's passed and it's determined that it is ambiguous, it's no longer between Congress and the agency determining what it means. It's between the court and the agency. And for reasons that I give in this paper, it's not at all clear to me that Congress, if they recognize that, would say, well, we'd rather have the courts determine this major question rather than the agency determine it. There are several reasons for that. One is that, as I've said before, the courts are less expert and less accountable. And so if Congress is acting in its sort of public interest-oriented way that people say it's not acting anymore, but we hope sometimes they could, you wouldn't think that would justify the court having the interpretive primacy in that context. In addition, if you're just thinking of Congress as a body that tries to, you know, do what's best for itself, its own power and influence, Congress can influence agencies much more than they can influence courts. They can cut off funding for agencies. I don't think in today's day and age it would go over well if the Congress decided to defund the Supreme Court or cut back on its funds. They can even do so in ways that give messages to the agency about how they want the agency to come out. They can call the agencies in for hearings, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, whether the court does it or the agency does it, they can always override that explicitly, but that's hard to do. There are many other mechanisms that the Congress can use to influence agencies that they can't use to influence courts. So I don't see any under this delegation approach, I really don't see any justification for the major question exception writ large. What there may be is if we realize it's between Congress and the agency, that what the courts might say is we're going to look really, really hard to see if we can discern what Congress what the statute says and what Congress did in this statute before we defer to the agency, because we don't think Congress would lightly let the agency decide this rather than decide it itself. But that really is a step one question. They might be a little less a little more hesitant to find a statute ambiguous, or maybe a lot more hesitant, and perhaps apply what the approach Scalia used generally, which was, I'm going to look at the statute. If I can come up with the best reading, that's the way I'm going to vote. And only if I really sit there and say, I really can't figure out what the way this should go, will I defer to agencies. So I can that's where the delegation kind of approach takes you on the major question issue. Again, my approach on the major question issue would say, I would prefer an agency do it as long as the agency has to justify its decision at step two in terms of the policy implications of the decision. I see I've just about used up my time, but that's not the only reason I'm out of things to say here. So I'll open it up to questions and really look forward to interacting with all of you who are listening.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Seidenfeld. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for Professor Seidenfeld, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. We've got one question pending. Again, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take our first question of the day.
Yes, good day. I'm calling from the Virgin Islands. This is Ned Jacobs. Our Supreme Court recently ruled that our executive agencies here will not have Chevron-type deference in their interpretation of laws that they administer. Are other states confronting this type of issue? I assume they have. Is Chevron-type deference typical in state context, and does the presenter have a preference for the states as to whether or not they should adopt the federal-style Chevron deference?
Okay, thanks for that question, Ned. I really don't follow what happens in the states in detail. I do know that many states have followed the feds previously in creating something like a Chevron doctrine. As you said, the Virgin Islands did and then abandoned it. I don't know if other states are abandoning that or not. From my perspective, I like Chevron. I think that it does make sense. From again, I'm not doing this as a formalist matter, but from a functionalist matter, because it separates out the question of what the legal restrictions on the agency are from the policy questions, and it makes it quite clear that the courts at step one are to determine the bounds of what the agency, what the statute says the agency can and cannot do. But when those bounds are unclear, it seems to me that the statute hasn't said to the agency, you can't do this, but they haven't said you must do this or you can do this. It seems to me that that as a policy matter, I would prefer to have the agencies use their expertise and their accountability for the value judgments that are inherent in these interpretive questions to make the decision. Again, you know, a lot of people say, well, you're leaving the agencies, you know, basically the foxes guarding the hen house. But you have to take into account my view of Chevron, which is that at step one, the court is going to, you know, seriously consider what the limitations that Congress has provided are. And at step two, they're going to say to the agency, you have to justify the policy implications, the policy decision that you've made, because that's essentially what's happened here. Once we say the statute is unclear, we're in the realm of saying it's really a policy question and not something where we can say Congress said you can't do this. So I don't think I actually like Chevron, but of course not necessarily the way it's been implemented by all the courts. But the courts, I think the Supreme Court has been moving more and more towards limiting Chevron. And one way they've done that is by limiting it at step two. For an example of that, I think would have been Scalia's, I think it's the EPA v. Michigan case, where the agency interpreted the statute to say we don't have to consider costs. And Scalia said, no, that's unreasonable. The statute doesn't really say explicitly you have to consider costs or not. But so you, it doesn't say what you have to consider, but costs are just fundamental to the notion of the kind of trade-offs that you have to make. And it's unreasonable to read the statute without it explicitly saying otherwise, that you can just ignore costs. So there are, I don't think that the agency is unconstrained. I just think that it has to be constrained in the right way. And the right way is not to have the court, you know, read tea leaves of statutes that are very unclear to say you should be able to do this or not, because that leads to arbitrariness, rather than say to the agency, well, if you could do it, tell us why you think it's a good thing that you do it, and we will review on that basis.
Once again, if you have a question for our expert, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one question pending, then our lines will be wide open. For now, let's take another call.
Hi, calling in from Drury Old, D.C. But I really appreciate the conversation, so thank you to the expert for enlightening us on Chevron. I actually had a more pointed question on a particular agency, that agency being the Federal Communications Commission and its promulgation of the Open Internet Order. And I know if there's obviously any reservation, please feel free to stop me. But I was wondering if there were any Chevron concerns in the promulgation of that order. I don't know if how well you've read up on it, but if you have, I'd be really interested to get your thoughts on it.
Well, hopefully you're still on the line and can still talk. My understanding was that under the Obama administration, they went to a kind of net neutrality kind of rule. And I did communications law for a while, so I understand that. I just don't know what you're referring to now. Is that the Obama order you're referring to, or is that something that's come out from the FCC since?
I'm sorry, is my mic still on?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, I'm actually referring to the Obama-style reg, so Title II.
Okay. Are there Chevron implications? I think there are Chevron implications. I don't know whether you are familiar with the Brand X case, which has implications for administrative law itself, but that actually came out of an issue of determining whether, in fact, the internet providers are actually, subject to Title II regulation under the FCC as telecommunications providers. And I used to actually do this kind of work. And if you read the statute, the statute says point-to-point, you know, telecommunication where the content is not controlled by the provider. It fits pretty handily within that definition. And in fact, the Ninth Circuit had so determined in the Brand X case, in a previous case, I don't remember the name of that case. And in Brand X, the FCC overruled that. And the court, in a funny way, the court has already said, yeah, under Chevron, this statute is ambiguous. And despite the fact that the Ninth Circuit disagreed with you, we think the statute's ambiguous enough to allow the agency to do that. Personally, I'm not sure it's that ambiguous or how it would come out on that. But that led to a very interesting aspect of Chevron, which says, and this is important if Chevron does get overruled, especially with the bills in Congress that are pending. Under the Brand X doctrine, an agency can change its own interpretation, even if that interpretation has been affirmed by the court, so long as the court said it's arbitrary at step. It's uncertain. The statute's silent or ambiguous at step one, and the agency's determination was permissible and reasonable. If the court says that, and the agency comes along and says, "Well, we have another reasonable interpretation that we prefer," and they give again the policy implications of that and the reasons why they prefer it, and that satisfies the court. The court in Brand X says that becomes the interpretation, despite the fact that there was a previous affirmance. So in some sense, both in terms of the particular doctrine, Chevron certainly would seem to apply there. The court has already said that. But in addition to that, it also, this very issue raised, and the Brand X case raises the issue of what happens if Congress comes along and says, we don't want, you know, Chevron's out, forget about Chevron. Or if the court says that, saying we're no longer going to use Chevron, which I think are two different scenarios. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I think there are certainly interesting Chevron implications from that doctrine as it's been applied.
Thank you.
Professor, this is Dean Reuter. I'm wondering about that Brand X rule. Are there any limitations on that with regard to sort of reliance interests? In other words, if the regulated community has for 40 years built itself up under one agency interpretation, which is, you know, reasonable and permissible, but then, you know, in the court's analysis of a change, say 180-degree reversal, would the court at all look to that reliance on the initial agency interpretation in analyzing the permissibility or the reasonableness of a different interpretation?
Well, again, the lower courts, I don't know if the lower courts have addressed that issue or whether the Supreme Court has addressed a Brand X issue at step two where they've determined it's unreasonable. But I've thought about that a lot. I think I've written about it. To me, that would be certainly something that would be a question of whether this is a reasonable interpretation. If you have 40 years of reliance and you've got investments in that, et cetera, one of the implications of changing that is that's going to have an effect on those investments. And the agency would certainly have to indicate what those effects would be and then indicate why they think the rule change is warranted despite those investments. And that would be evaluated the same way a rule change would be evaluated, in my opinion. So I think it's very relevant. It's interesting because one of the arguments for the major question exception someone came up with was, well, look, and this does actually fit some of the cases like the Brown and Williamson, you know, case involving the FDA's regulation of tobacco, King v. Burwell case in terms of the subsidies on federal-created exchanges in states. Both of those, one argument is, look, the court might not want the agency to be able to change that so readily back and forth, and therefore, by the court determining that Chevron doesn't apply and determining the answer, they have essentially said that the agency's discretion under Brand X to change its interpretation does not exist, that the court has come up with an interpretation that binds the agency. And that certainly would have the effect of taking care of those reliance costs. And in many cases, that might be justifiable. But I think that what people fail to recognize is exactly what you stated, which is the court is not powerless to make the agency address those at step two of Chevron the way I understand it. The court would say, well, great, you did this, but what are the effects of this, and are we going to sign off on that? Which to me, again, it's not as clear as saying you can't change it, but it might be that the reliance interests being what they are, it still warrants a change, and that gives the agency flexibility to at least try that and have the court evaluate that on the grounds where I think it should be evaluated, which is the reliance interest rather than on some kind of arbitrary, this is a major question, we've spoken once, therefore that's the answer, and it doesn't matter whether that's good or bad policy.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got two questions pending. Let's take another call.
Hi, this is Devin Watkins from the Cato Institute. I wonder if kind of the modern interpretation is kind of conflating two things, what I would call pure questions of law, whether a given word is one definition or another definition, or more vague questions where it may just be somewhat open on where the line drawing is. I don't have as much problem with the agencies doing some of the line drawing, but as to pure questions of law, I would think that Congress in the APA said the reviewing court shall decide all relevant questions of law, and that would be some directly telling the court to do this. And so for those pure questions of law, this should be somewhat of an easy question statutorily that Chevron wouldn't apply. What do you think about that?
I think that's great because in my first article, and others have written about this, is, you know, the APA, when Chevron was created, was quite clear. It says that questions of law should be decided by the reviewing court and constitutional questions. And then the court came up with Chevron, which again, I think undermines the notion that this is an implicit delegation from Congress when you have a statute that says if you're reviewing under the statute, which they were in Chevron, that's not the way it works. But The answer to my answer to that, and it's sort of similar, I think, in some ways to Henry Monaghan's answer when he first he did this before, I think, before Chevron was adopted. Could the courts do this? The court isn't ducking its responsibility if what it says is we are interpreting the statute the best we can, but because of institutional concerns and constraints, we think that the best way for us to interpret this statute, in other words, we have the authority to say, no, agency, you can't do that either at step one or at step two. But given the context, we think it's better to trust the agency. And so we take our view of what the statute means at this time from what the agency says it means. I'm not sure that that is necessarily the court not interpreting the statute. It seems to me that you could say that is an interpretation. It's a funny kind of interpretation, saying we can't figure out what this word means, rather than just guessing or saying, oh, well, we think that this is slightly better reading of the statute, but we're not at all sure that that's what the word should mean in this context. Rather than having that arbitrariness, the court might say, hey, a better way to do this is we're interpreting it, and our interpretation is we're going to do whatever the agency said is the best thing to do.
The problem to me is it seems to be placing a lot of power into the same hands to kind of write the regulation, interpret the regulation, to enforce the regulation. I mean, when you talk about kind of separation of power concerns, it really seems to undermine that to me.
I don't know if you're talking about a functional or formalistic perspective, but yeah, I can see how it seems that way. But remember, given my last answer to your question, the court can always come along and say, we just don't think that's what the statute means. And different judges, of course, I mean, part of the question is, what do you do at step one? Different judges have had different thresholds for deferring to the agency. As I said, Justice Scalia, at least he said, I'm not sure he always operated this way, but at least he said, if I read the statute and I say this is the better reading of the statute, there's a best reading, even if there's another close reading, I'm going to go with that. And if the agency didn't do that, I'm going to say that the agency acted beyond the permissible bounds. So if you take that narrow view of step one, that active view of, if you will, judicial view at step one, you're basically saying that the court is saying, what am I supposed to do when I really can't, you know, it's almost in equipoise. I really can't make a reasoned decision about what the statute should mean. There's really no choice at that point. The court has to do something. And the court says, hey, I got an out here, which is to allow the agency. Now, it does go further when some judges, I think Judge Silverman once made a statement to the effect that by the time something gets to the appellate court, it should be an ambiguous statute. The question should be unclear and the statute should be ambiguous, or there should be a Rule 11 sanction against one of the attorneys. I think that's more of a... That's a wider, perhaps too broad approach. But I think from the perspective of functionalism, I don't worry about runaway agencies, because I think the courts between step one and my step two courts have enough control over agencies to say, we're not going to let you just self deal here. You have to have good reasons for doing what you do. And they can't, good justifications. And I'm not so worried about that. From a formalistic perspective, I think it does, but from a formalistic perspective, I'm not sure that the distinction between interpreting and applying statutes is all that I'm not a jurisprude, and I'm sure that others have dealt with this more explicitly, but it seems like it's a line that's very hard to maintain.
Do you mind if I ask one more question real quick?
I don't.
No, this is Dean Reuter. Go right ahead. We've got about 20 minutes and only one question pending, so go right ahead.
I had a question about Thomas's concurrence in DOT v. American Association of Railroads. He makes kind of an originalist argument on the distinction between questions of fact and mixed questions of fact. And I'm just wondering, from an originalist standpoint, do you think Thomas is right there, or is he somewhat wrong as he incorporates kind of the non-delegation doctrine?
I don't know the opinion in detail, so it would be hard for me to say. But in terms of, the history of Chevron is also interesting, and I'm gonna say something here that I'll conjecture, so I can't say that I'm saying this for sure. But Justice Stevens drafted the opinion, and it was a 6-0 decision with three justices recusing themselves. It was not at all controversial, and I think that the Supreme Court thought that it was just doing what it had done in a case called Hearst, where it had said when you really can't distinguish between applying the law and interpreting the law, this is what Hearst said, we'll defer to the agency as long as it has warrant in the record and a reasonable basis in law. In other words, if you're filling gaps by point, saying in this case this is the outcome, we're really not very good at that, and we'll defer to the agency. Chevron, of course, didn't have that limitation and took it further. And of all people, it turns out that then judge and then later Justice Scalia really liked that and thought that that was appropriate. And when he was a D.C. Circuit judge, he and there were some other judges who seemed to take to it, Judge Wald on a different political perspective, but also seemed to take to it. So I'm not sure, you know, as an originalist perspective, I'd have to look at what Justice Thomas says, but I'm not sure that the people who again, it depends on what your original position is. I'm not sure that those who ratified the Constitution were at all aware of this kind of issue. And now if we are willing to go with the framers, but, you know, the current originalist position is that it's not what the framers said, it's what the ratifiers thought it meant. I just don't know enough about it to know whether they meant anything or whether their thoughts on this were sufficiently clear and universal that it's the kind of thing where I'd say, yeah, that's just the law. So it's a long answer to saying I'm not sure of the answer to that question. I'd have to read the opinion, but it doesn't sound to me like it's going to convince me.
We've now got two questions pending, so let's carry on.
Thank you very much, Professor. This is Paul Salamanca at the University of Kentucky. I have a question. I suppose it's at the intersection of functionalism and formalism, which phrases that you've invoked a few times, and I know exactly what you mean by that. Is it not fair to say that your thesis depends upon a fairly robust amount of confidence in the ability of the Congress to oversee the administrative state? And if that premise failed or were weak, wouldn't there then be some weakness in your overall thesis? And what I mean by that is Chevron deference does not so much it's not so much a question of whether it works to the advantage of an accountable branch of the government. It's which accountable branch of the government it works to. And under a formalist approach, I assume we like to think that legislation ultimately can be provenanced in the Congress, not in the executive branch. And so if I didn't share your optimism about the potential for oversight, wouldn't I get back to skepticism about Chevron, and wouldn't a fairly robust understanding of the non-delegation doctrine bring me to say that Chevron deference is inconsistent both on a functional and on a formalist basis with the Constitution?
No, I don't buy that. Here's my response to that. One is, I'm not sure. I'm not very hopeful or sanguine in that sense about Congress doing anything in any coherent fashion, or whether it's control the executive or take care of its own business. I don't know that matters though, because the bottom line is Congress acts in some sense when it has to act. It's going to do these things. In order to get things done, it's often going to find it necessary to empower the executive branch to do things. And then once it does that through the statute, I don't think it's I said this before, it's not Congress versus the executive. It's the courts versus the executive. Because you have to assume that while Congress might not monitor and control the executive branch as well as you might like, or maybe I might say I might like, it still does so and has the authority to do so more than the courts. So I guess from a formalistic perspective, there's some sense in saying this is a separation of powers problem. It should be the court's role to say what the law is. The problem is when the law is so unclear that the court can't do that, basically what you're saying is pick pick an answer arbitrarily, and formalistically, that's what we have to do because that's what the court's doing, rather than have an institution that can do better than that do what it did and have the court review that. So the problem is I guess I'm not following how this relates at all to congressional oversight of the executive branch. It seems to me, I guess in some sense as a comparative oversight, especially for the major question exceptions, but I don't see that to me that's an easy question. Congress may do a lousy job at overseeing the executive, but it doesn't even have the authority to oversee the courts in the same way other than by, you know, adopting, passing statutes to overrule or override court decisions, which it can do for agency decisions as well. If you want to follow up, I'd be happy, but I'm not sure I'm getting the implication.
Well, I partly it does get back to the question of the major questions doctrine. What I'm trying to suggest is that an administrative agency, which may be perfectly accountable to the president and maybe in some soft ways and some hard ways sometimes accountable to Congress, can go off in a direction that let's just assume there's some platonically discoverable congressional intent is not that. Chevron deference would validate that decision by the administrative agency and would not validate the underlying. And I concede I'm positing that there's some sort of platonic discoverable congressional intent.
But you have to posit that it's discoverable by the courts as well. And if it's discoverable by the courts, then presumably, again, depending on your view of statutory interpretation, the court could come back and say at step one, sorry, but this is impermissible. And if it's not discoverable by the courts, then you're saying the courts roll the dice for formalistic reasons rather than having the agency try to figure out what's best. So if it's discoverable, I don't see why the court can't come back at step one and say you've gone beyond what the statute allows.
How do you reconcile, and I'll stop asking you more, you've made a good point. How do you reconcile the idea of the basic concept of statutes and derogation? Isn't statutes and derogation a sort of the underlying theory, I guess you could say, of the major questions doctrine? And isn't that a legitimate part of constitutional or statutory interpretation?
Explain what you mean by statutes and derogation.
Well,
you say delegation or derogation?
Derogation. So if it's a massive deviation from well-established policy, it's disfavored in statutory interpretation. It's the sort of the antithesis of remedial statute should be construed broadly. So they're sort of the yin and yang of statutory interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Why couldn't that? Then, what I'm asking, why couldn't it? Wouldn't that at least be a theoretical justification for the major question doctrine?
Actually, in the short paper I wrote for this came out of a paper I wrote for a Cyril roundtable. I do find that may be the best explanation for what the court is doing, is to say basically it's not about whether this is a major question in a sense of statutory question. It's really about whether we're concerned about an evulsive change, and. Like I said, in the context of the tobacco Brown and Williamson tobacco case, that would clearly have been had significant ramifications in terms of authority and in terms of the effects on regulation of tobacco that Congress had not indicated one way. Well, it may have seemed to indicate that it didn't mean to do that, but it's not clear that that's true because the factual premises underlying the whole regulation had changed with some findings by the FDA. But it was certainly a major change in policy and law from what had existed before. And the Affordable Care Act, well, the whole act was a major change, whether you interpreted it one way or another. And the court said, we're a little concerned about if we interpret this a certain way that if we leave the agencies the ability to do this, which, by the way, they agreed with the agency's interpretation, although they didn't defer to the agency, they said that's going to really cause havoc in the insurance market. So we want to prevent havoc by allowing this flexibility to interpret it that way. But I would come back and say you've got step two to do that. And so it's not Congress. The real question is whether the courts, whether you trust the courts to be able to do that. And I do admit that you give more leeway to the executive branch somewhat with a Chevron doctrine, but not in a way. I think the major questions are the easy ones. I mean, it's not in the way that the major questions really are going to cause, oh my God, this is going to cause real havoc, because in those situations the political constraints are already pretty great, right? The political constraints on an agency doing something that creates real havoc, I think, are greater than when the agency does something that's of small significance, but arguably contrary to what you might have thought the statute meant. So again, I think you have to ask the question: is it really Congress versus the agency or courts versus the agency, and who's monitoring the agency?
We're down to our final 10 minutes or so. It looks like we're down to our final question as well.
Since we are dealing with the question of what power should be given to executive agencies to interpret law, it brings up the related question of the proposed act before Congress, now I believe the RAINS Act, which stands for Regulations from the Executive in Need of Scrutiny. And the purpose of that act, if it were to be enacted, would be to require Congress to approve major new rules and regulations issued by executive agencies before they can take effect. So I was wondering whether Professor Seidenfeld has an opinion on that.
I do, but let me. I've got about 10 minutes or 8 minutes here. Let me extend that to say there's also under the Separation of Powers Restoration Act, there's an explicit provision saying let's overrule Chevron. So I'll deal with both of those. Let me deal first with the one that explicitly says it wants to overrule Chevron. It's quite clear under the Supreme Court's rationale for Chevron that that would eliminate Chevron as we know it. Now, we'd still have Skidmore deference, and who knows what the court's reaction would be. But if Chevron is based or even could be based on my rationale, it gets you something, but it doesn't get you as far. It gets you, I think, is, in my opinion, as far as where I'd say the major question exception gets you currently, which is to say Congress has said that we don't want deference to the agency. Courts, we want you to determine what the statute means for separation of powers reasons or whatever reason. And there, I think the answer is the court's going to have to work really, really hard and perhaps take more risks that it says, well, there are two reasonable interpretations here. There's ambiguity. But we think, in other words, take more of the Scalia approach and apply it consistently. We think that in reading the statute, the structure of the statute, whatever else the court's going to use to interpret the statute, that the meaning of the statute, this is a slightly better reading. The court said, the Congress has said we should interpret that. So that's the reading. But if they simply get to the point where they say, at this point, we're just you know, reading tea leaves or throwing up our hands and saying we got to pick one, I think that even if Congress said no Chevron deference, the court could say, as a matter of our institutional way of determining the outcome, we are going to that might be close to Skidmore deference, but it doesn't necessarily have the same baggage of requiring that the agency be within the kind of expertise of the agency or show the same kind of powers to persuade, if not the powers to control, that Justice Jackson talked about. So even with the bill that says let's reverse and overrule Chevron, there may be what I would call the ghost of Chevron may hang around. It wouldn't be Chevron quite as we know it, but we might have a Chevron doctrine with a much more active step one, and I would hope an active step two from my perspective. As to the RAINS Act itself, on the major questions, Congress can do that. I actually, for reasons unrelated to Chevron, but very much related to arbitrary and capricious review, and it's something that I'm meaning to sort of blog about, and I haven't gotten around to it. I'm skeptical of for the following reason. I think that might create, in a funny way, less accountability, at least to the people, if not necessarily to Congress, over administrative action. So an agency comes along and has rulemaking authority. It comes up with a rule that is a major rule. Everyone recognizes it's a major rule. No controversy about that. Under the RAINS Act, once we say it's a major rule, that once the agency adopts it, that rule would essentially become a proposal to Congress to be voted on under a procedure similar to the Congressional Review Act now for an up-down vote with no amendments to Congress. So let's say Congress affirms that rule, right? Now, currently, with Congress not affirming the rule, courts have the authority to review that under arbitrary and capricious. I'm not so sure that you could say that the courts could do that once Congress votes on it, right? The court says, well, they didn't justify, we're not saying it's a bad rule or a good rule, but the agency never justified why they did this. And then you say, but Congress voted on it and passed it. So in that situation, that's something I think don't think people have thought about is if we have the RAINS Act, I'm not sure we can maintain arbitrary, capricious, hard look review. And I do think I've written a lot on that. I think that is a very, very important constraint on agencies because it makes the agencies really consider lots of different factors. I think it guards against capture. I think it guards against sloppiness. It may be costly, but I think, you know, if we do away with that, then I think you will have given the administrative state, obviously it has to be approved by Congress, but Congress, as someone mentioned, isn't always so great at monitoring and figuring out what's going on anyway. That might actually give more power to the administrative state because it could be sloppier and captured and still get things through. So that's a funny take on it. It has nothing to do with Chevron, but I do fear that.
Well, Professor Seidenfeld, it looks like we've had our final question for the day. We've got a couple minutes left. Let me give you a chance to wrap up or express any final thought you might have on the topic.
Well, again, I appreciate the opportunity to speak to people and have people listen to me. I think this is an interesting approach to Chevron, an interesting question about Chevron, but to me, and I've written this is my first article on Chevron way back in 1994, the key to controlling agencies appropriately is having the courts engage in that hard look review, making the agencies justify their decisions, and I think that my understanding of the justification for Chevron, the non-fictional one, might be a better way of getting courts to do that. Although I don't really care which way we do it. If courts do that, I think that we're in pretty good shape. So thanks again, everyone.
Well, thank you, Professor, on behalf of the Federal Society. And personally, I want to thank you for joining us today. This has been very illuminating. Thanks also to the audience for dialing in. A reminder to check the website and monitor your emails for breaking news telephone conference calls. Tomorrow's another decision day in the Supreme Court, but we do also have a teleforum scheduled tomorrow at 12:30 p.m., a regulatory transparency project teleforum. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.